Okay, pop quiz. What do a teenager's bedroom, a plant, and the ACTs have in common? Give up.
They're all surprisingly good at explaining research methods.
And trust me, understanding this stuff is way more useful than you might think, right?
Hmm.
We're talking about the building blocks of how we study, measure, and ultimately understand human behavior.
The
So.
foundation of so much of what we know.
Exactly. And joining us for this crash course is an expert in the field. She's like our research whisperer,
I like that.
making even the trickiest concepts crystal clear. So let's dive right in with a concept that trips up a lot of people: internal versus external validity. Have you ever heard advice that just didn't quite translate in the real world?
Oh, absolutely.
Like maybe a crisis hotline that recommends calling the police if a teenager locks themselves in their bedroom?
What's fascinating is that this example gets right to the heart of internal validity. See, in some cultures, calling the police in that situation would be a last resort, right? The question of whether that's the right response depends heavily on the cultural context.
It's like my first thought would be to take the door off the hinges, not call the cops. And that difference in perspective is crucial because it highlights how our own cultural lens can shape, even subconsciously, the questions we ask and how we interpret those research results.
Absolutely. And for researchers, this means being incredibly mindful about how their own background might influence their work. It's not enough to have good intentions. You need a research design that actually accounts for these differences to make sure the findings hold water across diverse populations.
So it's not just about whether the research is valid in one specific setting, it's about whether those findings can be generalized more broadly.
Think about it this way. Just because something's true for one group doesn't mean it's true for everyone.
Right. Okay, speaking of things being valid, let's shift gears to another fundamental concept: independent and dependent variables. Remember those plant experiments back in school? Turns out they're not just for making your classroom smell like fertilizer.
So, I do have fond memories of that.
They perfectly illustrate this idea.
Ah, yes, the classic, let's see what happens when we give this plant soda instead of water experiment. It's a rite of passage for budding scientists.
Exactly. And even if our methods were a little questionable back then, the basic principle holds true. The type of liquid we give the plant, that's the independent variable, that's what we're manipulating, and the plant's growth, that's what we're measuring to see if our little experiment had any effect. That's our dependent variable.
Precisely. Think of it this way. The dependent variable depends on the independent variable.
It's like if we were studying a new therapy for anxiety, the therapy itself would be the independent variable, right? That's what we're controlling and changing. And the client's anxiety levels, those would be the dependent variable. That's what we're measuring to see if the therapy is working.
Exactly. Now you're thinking like a researcher. But understanding variables is just one piece of the puzzle. We also need to consider how different research designs play out over time, and that's where longitudinal versus cross-sectional studies come in.
So imagine we're trying to understand the long-term effects of, say, a new health trend.
Okay.
A cross-sectional study would be like snapping a single photo, right? We'd get a glimpse of people who are currently into that trend and compare them to those who aren't.
It's a snapshot in time helpful for spotting potential patterns,
Right.
but it doesn't tell us the whole story. On the other hand, a longitudinal study that's like creating a time-lapse video, we'd follow a group of people over years, even decades, to see how their health evolves in relation to that trend.
That makes me think of all those long-term studies on things like smoking or diet. It's those years of data that really paint a clear picture, right?
Exactly. Think about it. Early research on smoking couldn't have possibly predicted the full range of health consequences we now know about. It was only through longitudinal studies tracking people over decades that we could definitively link smoking to lung cancer, heart disease, and a whole host of other problems.
Wow. That's a powerful example of how the type of study design dramatically impacts what we learn. It's like the difference between a quick glance and a deep dive, pun intended. Okay, ready for another research term that sounds way more intimidating than it actually is?
Let's hear it.
Let's talk about the correlation coefficient, or Pearson's R.
Don't let those dull. Oh, it's a scary one.
Don't let the R word scare you. It's just a fancy way of measuring how closely two things are related, like how well you can predict one thing based on another. So it's like if we know your shoe size, we could probably make a decent guess about your height.
Right.
But it wouldn't be a perfect prediction, right?
Exactly. And the correlation coefficient gives us a number to represent that relationship. A perfect positive correlation, where things move perfectly in sync, would be a 1.0. A perfect negative correlation, where one goes up as the other goes down, is a negative 1.0.
Okay.
But most things in life fall somewhere in between.
And our expert, through her research, gave us a helpful tip, she says, to think of 0.7 as a sort of passing grade for a meaningful correlation.
I like that analogy.
Anything less than that, and the relationship might not be strong enough to draw any conclusions from.
And here's the catch. Even a strong correlation doesn't automatically mean one thing causes the other.
Wait, so just because two things are related doesn't mean one is causing the other? My mind is a little blown right now.
It's a common misconception. Think of it like this. Imagine you notice that ice cream sales and crime rates both tend to go up during the summer.
Okay.
That's a correlation, but does that mean eating ice cream causes people to commit crimes?
Okay, that's hilarious and also makes perfect sense. There are obviously other factors at play, like the heat, right?
Precisely. That's why researchers get so excited about experiments. They're designed to figure out if there's a true cause and effect relationship.
Which leads us perfectly to a research design that's especially relevant if you're interested in actually changing behavior. Single subject design.
This one's all about tracking changes in an individual or a small group over time, and it's often used to see if an intervention is actually making a difference.
So instead of looking at large groups, we're zooming in on how one person responds to a specific intervention.
Exactly. And the beauty of single subject design is its simplicity. It's often represented by the acronym ABA.
Okay.
A represents the baseline. That's where you're measuring what's happening before any intervention. B is when you introduce the intervention.
So let's say you're trying to help a student focus better in class.
Yeah.
The A would be measuring how much time they're spending on task before introducing any new strategies.
Yeah, exactly. Then you'd introduce your intervention, maybe a fidget toy or a designated break time. That's your B. Then you'd go back to A, measure their on-task behavior again without the intervention.
Right.
Finally, you'd reintroduce the intervention, the second B, to see if you consistently see those positive changes.
So it's like measure, intervene, measure again, intervene again.
Mm-hmm.
And this repetition helps researchers see if the intervention is truly making a difference or if it's just a coincidence.
And this ABAB design is incredibly helpful for social workers, therapists, teachers, anyone working directly with individuals to figure out what's working and what's not.
Okay, last but not least, let's demystify a term you might hear thrown around in research settings.
Mm.
Quasi-experiments. Our expert mentioned this as the preferred method for research within agencies, and I'm so curious to hear why that might be. It's like, in a perfect world, you'd be able to randomly assign clients to different groups, right?
Right.
And perfectly control the factors to see what really works.
Yeah.
But in the real world, that's not always possible or ethical.
Exactly. Imagine you're a social worker at an agency and you have clients coming to you with a specific need.
Right.
It wouldn't be right to withhold a potentially helpful intervention from some clients just because they were randomly assigned to a control group, right?
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. So yeah. Quasi-experiments are a way to study real-world situations where you can't control everything.
Exactly. They give researchers the flexibility to study interventions and programs as they're actually being implemented.
Yeah.
You might not have the perfect control of a lab setting, but you gain valuable insights into what works in the messy, complicated real world.
This has been such an eye-opening conversation. I feel like I've just unlocked a secret level of understanding when it comes to research.
And that's the power of understanding research methods. It's not just about memorizing terms. It's about being able to critically evaluate information and make more informed decisions in all areas of your life.
It's like having a superpower. You can cut through the noise and figure out what's really important.
Absolutely. Now that you're armed with this knowledge, pay attention to how research is discussed in the news and articles, even in casual conversations. Do those claims hold up? Are they based on solid evidence or just someone's opinion?
Such a good point. I'm already starting to look at information differently. Well, we've covered a ton of ground in this deep dive, from understanding those basic building blocks like variables and validity to exploring different research designs. I hope you're feeling as energized as I am about navigating the world of research. And remember, learning is a lifelong journey. So keep asking questions, keep exploring, and keep those brains buzzing. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.